Each variable, it turns out, has an important twist. One might think that if a lot of democracy is a good thing in inhibiting war, then a little democracy is still better than none. But with civil wars, it doesn't work that way. Earlier in the chapter, and in Chapter 3 when we examined homicide across the world, we came across the concept of anocracy, a form of rule that is neither fully democratic nor fully autocratic. Anocracies are also known among political scientists as semi-democracies, praetorian regimes, and, my favorite, overheard at a conference, crappy governments. These are administrations that don't do anything well. Unlike autocratic police states, they don't intimidate their populations into quiescence, but nor do they have the more or less fair systems of law enforcement of a decent democracy. Instead, they often respond to local crime with indiscriminate retaliation on entire communities. They retain the kleptocratic habits of the autocracies from which they evolved, doling out tax revenues and patronage jobs to their clansmen, who then extort bribes for police protection, favorable verdicts in court, or access to the endless permits needed to get anything done. A government job is the only ticket out of squalor, and having a Klansman in power is the only ticket to a government job. When control of the government is periodically up for grabs in a democratic election, the stakes are as high as in any contest over precious and indivisible spoils. Clans, tribes, and ethnic groups try to intimidate each other away from the ballot box and then fight to overturn an outcome that doesn't go their way. According to the Global Report on Conflict, Governance, and State Fragility, autocracies are about 6 times more likely than democracies and 2.5 times as likely as autocracies to experience new outbreaks of societal wars, such as ethnic civil wars, revolutionary wars, and coup d'etat. We saw in the preceding chapter why the vulnerability of anocracies to violence has become a problem. As the number of autocracies in the world began to decline in the late 1980s, the number of anocracies began to increase. Currently, they are distributed in a crescent from Central Africa through the Middle East and West and South Asia that largely coincides with the war zones. The vulnerability to civil war of countries in which control of the government is a winner-take-all jackpot is multiplied when the government controls windfalls like oil, gold, diamonds, and strategic minerals. Far from being a blessing, these bonanzas create the so-called resource curse, also known as the paradox of plenty and fool's gold. Countries with an abundance of non-renewable, easily monopolized resources have slower economic growth, crappier governments, and more violence. As the Venezuelan politician Juan Perez Alfonso put it, oil is the devil's excrement. A country can be accursed by these resources because they concentrate power and wealth in the hands of whoever monopolizes them, typically a governing elite, but sometimes a regional warlord. The leader becomes obsessed with fending off rivals for his cash cow and has no incentive to foster the networks of commerce that enriches society and knit it together in reciprocal obligations. Collier, together with the economist Dambisa Moyo and other policy analysts, has called attention to a related paradox. Foreign aid, so beloved of crusading celebrities, can be another poisoned chalice, because it can enrich and empower the leaders through whom it is funneled, rather than building a sustainable economic infrastructure. Expensive contraband like cocoa, opium, and diamonds is a third curse, because it opens a niche for cutthroat politicians or warlords to secure the illegal enclaves and distribution channels. Collier observes that the countries at the bottom coexist with the 21st century, but their reality is the 14th century. Civil war, plague, ignorance. The analogy to that calamitous century, which stood on the verge of the civilizing process before the consolidation of effective governments, is apt. In The Remnants of War, Mueller notes that most armed conflict in the world today no longer consists of campaigns for territory by professional armies. It consists instead of plunder, intimidation, revenge, and rape by gangs of unemployable young men, serving warlords or local politicians, much like the dregs rounded up by medieval barons for their private wars. As Mueller puts it, many of these wars have been labeled new war, ethnic conflict, or most grandly, clashes of civilizations. But in fact, most, though not all, are more nearly opportunistic predation by packs, often remarkably small ones, of criminals, bandits, and thugs. They engage in armed conflict either as mercenaries hired by desperate governments or as independent or semi-independent warlord or brigand bands. The damage perpetrated by these entrepreneurs of violence, who commonly apply ethnic, nationalist, civilizational, or religious rhetoric, can be extensive, particularly to the citizens who are their chief prey, but it is scarcely differentiable from crime. Mueller cites eyewitness reports that confirm that the infamous civil wars and genocides of the 1990s were largely perpetrated by gangs of drugged or drunken hooligans, including those in Bosnia, Colombia, Croatia, East Timor, Kosovo, Liberia, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, Somalia, Zimbabwe, and other countries in the African-Asian conflict crescent. Mueller describes some of the soldiers in the 1989 through 96 Liberian Civil War. Combatants routinely styled themselves after heroes in violent American action movies like Rambo, Terminator, and Jungle Killer, and many went under such fanciful nom de guerre as Colonel Action, Captain Mission Impossible, General Murder, Young Colonel Killer, General Jungle King, Colonel Evil Killer, General War Boss 3, General Jesus, Major Trouble, General Butt Naked, and of course, General Rambo. Particularly in the early years, rebels decked themselves out in bizarre, even lunatic attire, women's dresses, wigs, and pantyhose, decorations composed of human bones, painted fingernails, even, perhaps in only one case, headgear made of a flowery toilet seat. The political scientists James Fearon and David Layton have backed up such vignettes with data confirming that civil wars today are fought by small numbers of lightly armed men who use their knowledge of the local landscape to elude national forces and intimidate informants and government sympathizers. These insurgencies and rural guerrilla wars may have any number of pretexts, but at heart they are less ethnic, religious, or ideological contests than turf battles between street gangs or mafiosi. In a regression analysis of 122 civil wars between 1945 and 1999, Fearon and Layton found that, holding per capita income constant, which they interpret as a proxy for government resources, civil wars were not more likely to break out in countries that were ethnically or religiously diverse, that had policies which discriminated against minority religions or languages, or that had high levels of income inequality. Civil wars were more likely to break out in countries that had large populations, mountainous terrain, new or unstable governments, significant oil exports, and, perhaps, a large proportion of young males. Fearon and Layton conclude, our theoretical interpretation is more Hobbesian than economic. Where states are relatively weak and capricious, both fears and opportunities encourage the rise of local would-be rulers who supply a rough justice while arrogating the power to tax for themselves and often a larger cause. Just as the uptick in civil warfare arose from the decivilizing anarchy of decolonization, the recent decline may reflect the re-civilizing process in which competent governments have begun to protect and serve their citizens rather than preying on them. Many African nations have traded in their Bokassa-style psychopaths for responsible democrats and, in the case of Nelson Mandela, one of history's great statesmen. The transition required an ideological change as well, not just in the affected countries, but in the wider international community. The historian Gérard Prunier has noted that in 1960s Africa, independence from colonial rule became a messianic ideal. New nations made it a priority to adopt the trappings of sovereignty, such as airlines, palaces, and nationally branded institutions. Many were influenced by dependency theorists who advocated that third world governments disengage from the global economy and cultivate self-sufficient industries and agrarian sectors, which most economists today consider a ticket to penury. Often economic nationalism was combined with a romantic militarism that glorified violent revolution, symbolized in two icons of the 1960s, the soft-color portrait of a glowing Mao and the hard-edged graphic of a dashing Che. When dictatorships by glorious revolutionaries lost their cachet, democratic elections became the new elixir. No one found much romance in the frumpy institutions of the civilizing process, namely a competent government and police force and a dependable infrastructure for trade and commerce. Yet history suggests that these institutions are necessary for the reduction of chronic violence, which is a prerequisite to every other social good. During the past two decades, the great powers, donor nations, and intergovernmental organizations, such as the African Union, have begun to press the point. They have ostracized, penalized, shamed, and in some cases invaded states that have come under the control of incompetent tyrants. Measures to track and fight government corruption have become more common, as has the identification of barriers that penalize developing nations in global trade. Some combination of these unglamorous measures may have begun to reverse the governmental and social pathologies that had loosed civil wars on the developing world from the 1960s through the early 1990s. Decent governments tend to be reasonably democratic and market-oriented, and several regression studies have looked at datasets on civil conflict for signs of a liberal peace, like the one that helps explain the avoidance of wars between developed nations. We have already seen that the first leg of the peace, democracy, does not reduce the number of civil conflicts, particularly when it comes in the rickety form of an anocracy, but it does seem to reduce their severity. The political scientist Bethany Lacina has found that civil wars in democracies have fewer than half the battle deaths of civil wars in non-democracies, holding the usual variables constant. In his 2008 survey of the liberal peace, Gleditsch concluded that democracies rarely experience large-scale civil wars. The second leg of the liberal peace is even stronger. Openness to the global economy, including trade, foreign investment, aid with strings attached, and access to economic media, appears to drive down both the likelihood and the severity of civil conflict. The theory of the Kantian peace places the weight of peace on three legs, the third of which is international organizations. One type of international organization in particular can claim much of the credit for driving down civil wars, international peacekeeping forces. In the post-colonial decades, civil wars piled up, not so much because they broke out at an increasing rate, but because they broke out at a higher rate than they ended, 2.2 outbreaks a year compared to 1.8 terminations, and thus began to accumulate. By 1999, an average civil war had been going on for 15 years. That began to change in the late 1990s and 2000s, when civil wars started to fizzle out faster than new ones took their place. They also tended to end in negotiated settlements without a clear victor, rather than being fought to the bitter end. Formerly, these embers would smolder for a couple of years and then flare up again, but now they were more likely to die out for good. This burst of peace coincides with a burst of peacekeepers. Beginning in the late 1980s, the international community stepped up its peacekeeping operations and, more importantly, staffed them with increasing numbers of peacekeepers so that they could do their job properly. The end of the Cold War was a turning point, because at last the great powers were more interested in seeing a conflict end than in seeing their proxy win. The rise of peacekeeping is also a sign of the humanist times. War is increasingly seen as repugnant, and that includes wars that kill black and brown people. Peacekeeping is one of the things that the United Nations, for all its foibles, does well. It doesn't do so well at preventing wars in the first place. In Does Peacekeeping Work?, the political scientist Virginia Page Fortna answers the question in her title with a clear and resounding yes. Fortna assembled a data set of 115 ceasefires in the civil wars from 1944 to 1997 and examined whether the presence of a peacekeeping mission lowered the chances that the war would reignite. The data set included missions by the UN, by permanent organizations such as NATO and the African Union, and by ad hoc coalitions of states. She found that the presence of peacekeepers reduced the risk of recidivism into another war by 80%. This doesn't mean that peacekeeping missions are always successful. The genocides in Bosnia and Rwanda are two conspicuous failures. Just that they prevent wars from restarting on average. Peacekeepers need not be substantial armies. Just as scrawny referees can pull apart brawling hockey players, lightly armed and even unarmed missions can get in between militias and induce them to lay down their weapons. And even when they don't succeed at that, they can serve as a tripwire for bringing in the bigger guns. Nor do peacekeepers have to be blue-helmeted soldiers. Functionaries who scrutinize elections, reform the police, monitor human rights, and oversee the functioning of bad governments also make a difference. Why does peacekeeping work? The first reason comes right out of Leviathan. The larger and better armed missions can retaliate directly against violators of a peace agreement on either side, raising the costs of aggression. The imposed costs and benefits can be reputational as well as material. A member of a mission commented on what led Afonso Dhlakama and his Renamo rebel force to sign a peace agreement with the government of Mozambique. For Dhlakama, it meant a great deal to be taken seriously, to go to cocktail parties and be treated with respect. Through the UN, he got the government to stop calling Renamo armed bandits. It felt good to be wooed. Even small missions can be effective at keeping a peace because they can free the adversaries from a Hobbesian trap in which each side is tempted to attack out of fear of being attacked first. The very act of accepting intrusive peacekeepers is a costly, hence credible, signal that each side is serious about not attacking. Once the peacekeepers are in place, they can reinforce this security by monitoring compliance with the agreement, which allows them to credibly reassure each side that the other is not secretly rearming. They can also assume everyday policing activities, which deter the small acts of violence that can escalate into cycles of revenge. And they can identify the hotheads and spoilers who want to subvert the agreement. Even if a spoiler does launch a provocative attack, the peacekeepers can credibly reassure the target that it was a rogue act rather than the opening shot in a resumption of aggression. Peacekeeping initiatives have other levers of influence. They can try to stamp out the trade in contraband that finances rebels and warlords, who are often the same people. They can dangle pork barrel funding as an incentive to leaders who abide by the peace, enhancing their power and electoral popularity. As one Sierra Leonean said of a presidential candidate, "If Kaba go, white man go, UN go, money go." Also, since third world soldiers, like pre-modern soldiers, are often paid in opportunities to plunder, the money can be applied to demobilization, disarmament, and reintegration programs that aim to draw General Butt Naked and his comrades back into civil society. With guerrillas who have more of an ideological agenda, the fact that the bribes come from a neutral party rather than a despised enemy allows them to feel they have not sold out. Leverage can also be applied to force political leaders to open their governments to rival political or ethnic groups. As with the financial sweeteners, the fact that the concessions are made to a neutral party rather than to the hated foe provides the conceder with an opportunity to save face. Desmond Malloy, a UN worker in Sierra Leone, observed that peacekeepers create an atmosphere for negotiations. Concessions become a point of pride. It's a human trait. So you need a mechanism that allows negotiations without losing dignity and pride. For all these encouraging statistics, newsreaders who are familiar with the carnage in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Iraq, Sudan, and other death traps may not be reassured. The prior UCDP data we have been examining are limited in two ways. They include only state-based conflicts, wars in which at least one of the sides is a government, and they include only battle-related deaths, fatalities caused by battlefield weapons. What happens to the trends when we start looking for the keys that don't fall under these lampposts? The first exclusion consists of the non-state conflicts, also called intercommunal violence, in which warlords, militias, mafias, rebel groups, or paramilitaries, often affiliated with ethnic groups, go after each other. These conflicts usually occur in failed states, almost by definition. A war that doesn't even bother to invite the government represents the ultimate failure of the state's monopoly on violence. The problem with non-state conflicts is that until recently, war buffs just weren't interested in them. No one kept track, so there's nothing to count, and we cannot plot the trends. Even the United Nations, whose mission is to prevent the scourge of war, refuses to keep statistics on intercommunal violence or on any other form of armed conflict because its member states don't want social scientists poking around inside their borders and exposing the violence that their murderous governments cause or their inept governments fail to prevent. Nonetheless, a broad look at history suggests that non-state conflicts today must be far fewer than they were in decades and centuries past, when less of the Earth's surface was controlled by states. Tribal battles, slave raids, pillagings by raiders and horse tribes, pirate attacks, and private wars by noblemen and warlords, all of them non-state, were scourges of humanity for millennia. During China's warlord era, from 1916 through 1928, more than 900,000 people were killed by competing military chieftains in just a dozen years. It was only in 2002 that non-state conflicts began to be tabulated. Since then, the UCDP has maintained a non-state conflict data set, and it contains three revelations. First, non-state conflicts are in some years as numerous as state-based conflicts, which says more about the scarcity of war than about the prevalence of intercommunal combat. Most of them, not surprisingly, are in sub-Saharan Africa, though a growing number are in the Middle East, most prominently Iraq. Second, non-state conflicts kill far fewer people than conflicts that involve a government, perhaps a quarter as many. Again, this is not surprising, since governments almost by definition are in the violence business. Third, the trend in the death toll from 2002 to 2008, the most recent year covered in the data set, has been mostly downward, despite 2007's being the deadliest year for intercommunal violence in Iraq. So, as best as anyone can tell, it seems unlikely that non-state conflicts kill enough people to stand as a counterexample to the decline in the worldwide toll of armed conflict that constitutes the new peace. A more serious challenge is the number of indirect deaths of civilians from the hunger, disease, and lawlessness exacerbated by war. One often reads that a century ago, only 10% of the deaths in war were suffered by civilians, but that today the figure is 90%. Consistent with this claim are new surveys by epidemiologists that reveal horrendous numbers of excess deaths, direct and indirect, among civilians. Rather than counting bodies from media reports and non-governmental organizations, surveyors ask a sample of people whether they know someone who was killed, then extrapolate the proportion to the population as a whole. One of these surveys, published in the medical journal Lancet in 2006, estimated that 600,000 people died in the war in Iraq between 2003 and 2006, overwhelmingly more than the 80,000 to 90,000 battle deaths counted for that period by PRIO and by the Iraq Body Count, a respected non-governmental organization. Another survey in the Democratic Republic of the Congo put the death toll from its civil war at 5.4 million, about 35 times the PRIO battle death estimate, and more than half of the total of all battle deaths it has recorded in all wars since 1946. Even granting that the PRIO figures are intended as lower bounds, because of the stringent requirements that deaths be attributed to a cause, this is quite a discrepancy, and raises doubts about whether, in the big picture, the decline in battle deaths can really be interpreted as an advance in peace. Casualty figures are always moralized, and it's not surprising that these three numbers, which have been used to indict, respectively, the 20th century, Bush's invasion of Iraq, and the world's indifference to Africa, have been widely disseminated. But an objective look at the sources suggests that the revisionist estimates are not credible, which, needless to say, does not imply that anyone should be indifferent to civilian deaths in wartime. First off, the commonly cited 10% to 90% reversal in civilian casualties turns out to be completely bogus. The political scientists Andrew Mack of HSRP, Joshua Goldstein, and Adam Roberts have each tried to track down the source of this meme, since they all knew that the data needed to underpin it do not exist. They also knew that the claim fails basic sanity checks. For much of human history, peasants have subsisted on what they could grow, producing little in the way of surplus. A horde of soldiers living off the land could easily tip a rural population into starvation. The 30 Years' War, in particular, saw not only numerous massacres of civilians, but the deliberate destruction of homes, crops, livestock, and water supplies, adding up to truly horrendous civilian death tolls. The American Civil War, with its blockades, crop burnings, and scorched earth campaigns, caused an enormous number of civilian casualties. The historical reality behind Scarlett O'Hara's vow in Gone with the Wind, "As God is my witness, I'll never be hungry again." During World War I, the battlefront moved through populated areas, raining artillery shells on towns and villages, and each side tried to starve the other's civilians with blockades. As I have mentioned, if one includes the victims of the 1918 flu epidemic as indirect deaths from the war, one could multiply the number of civilian casualties many times over. World War II, also in the first half of the 20th century, decimated civilians with the Holocaust, a Blitz, Slaughterhouse Five-like firebombings of cities in Germany and Japan, and not one but two atomic explosions. It seems unlikely that today's wars, however destructive to civilians, could be substantially worse. Goldstein, Roberts, and Mack traced the meme to a chain of garbled retellings in which different kinds of casualty estimates were mashed up. Battle deaths in one era were compared with battle deaths, indirect deaths, injuries, and refugees in another. Mack and Goldstein estimate that civilians suffer around half of the battle deaths in war, and that the ratio varies from war to war, but has not increased over time. Indeed, we shall see that it has recently decreased by a substantial margin. The most widely noted of the recent epidemiological estimates is the Lancet studies of death in Iraq. A team of eight Iraqi health workers went door to door in 18 regions and asked people about recent deaths in the family. The epidemiologists subtracted the death rate for the years before the 2003 invasion from the death rate for the years after, figuring that the difference could be attributed to the war, and multiplied that proportion by the size of the population of Iraq. The arithmetic suggested that 655,000 more Iraqis died than if the invasion had never taken place, and 92% of these excess deaths, the families indicated, were direct battle deaths from gunshots, airstrikes, and car bombs, not indirect deaths from disease or starvation. If so, the standard body counts would be underestimates by a factor of around 7. Without meticulous criteria for selecting a sample, though, extrapolations to an entire population can be wildly off. A team of statisticians led by Michael Spaggett and Neil Johnson found these estimates incredible, and discovered that a disproportionate number of the surveyed families lived on major streets and intersections, just the places where bombings and shootings are most likely. An improved study conducted by the World Health Organization came up with a figure that was a quarter of the Lancet number, and even that required inflating an original estimate by a fudge factor of 35% to compensate for lying, moves, and memory lapses. Their unadjusted figure, around 110,000, is far closer to the battle death body counts. Another team of epidemiologists extrapolated from retrospective surveys of war deaths in 13 countries to challenge the entire conclusion that battle deaths have declined since the middle of the 20th century. Spaggett, Mack, and their collaborators have examined them and shown that the estimates are all over the map and are useless for tracking war deaths over time. What about the report of 5.4 million deaths, 90% of them from disease and hunger, in the civil war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo? It also turns out to be inflated. The International Rescue Committee, IRC, got the number by taking an estimate of the pre-war death rate that was far too low, because it came from sub-Saharan Africa as a whole, which is better off than the DRC, and subtracting it from an estimate of the rate during the war that was far too high, because it came from areas where the IRC was providing humanitarian assistance, which are just the areas with the highest impact from war. The HSRP, while acknowledging that the indirect death toll in the DRC is high, probably over a million, cautions against accepting estimates of excess deaths from retrospective survey data, since in addition to all of their sampling pitfalls, they require dubious conjectures about what would have happened if a war had not taken place. Amazingly, the HSRP has collected evidence that death rates from disease and hunger have tended to go down, not up, during the wars of the past three decades. It may sound like they are saying that war is healthy for children and other living things after all, but that is not their point. Instead, they document that deaths from malnutrition and hunger in the developing world have been dropping steadily over the years, and that the civil wars of today, which are fought by packs of insurgents in limited regions of a country, have not been destructive enough to reverse the tide. In fact, when medical and food assistance is rushed to a war zone, where it is often administered during humanitarian ceasefires, the progress can accelerate. How is this possible? Many people are unaware of what UNICEF calls the child survival revolution. The revolution pertains to adult survival too, though children under five are the most vulnerable population and hence the ones most dramatically helped. Humanitarian assistance has gotten smarter. Rather than just throwing money at a problem, aid organizations have adapted discoveries from the science of public health about which scourges kill the most people and which weapon against each one is the most cost-effective. Most childhood deaths in the developing world come from four causes: malaria, diarrheal diseases such as cholera and dysentery, respiratory infections such as pneumonia, influenza, and tuberculosis, and measles. Each is preventable or treatable, often remarkably cheaply. Mosquito nets, anti-malarial drugs, antibiotics, water purifiers, oral rehydration therapy, a bit of salt and sugar in clean water, vaccinations and breastfeeding, which reduces diarrheal and respiratory diseases, can save enormous numbers of lives. Over the last three decades, vaccination alone, which in 1974 protected just 5% of the world's children and today protects 75%, has saved 20 million lives. Ready-to-use therapeutic foods like Plumpy Nut, a peanut butterish goop in a foil package that children are said to like, can make a big dent in malnutrition and starvation. Together, these measures have slashed the human costs of war and belied the worry that an increase in indirect deaths has canceled or swamped the decrease in battle deaths. The HSRP estimates that during the Korean War, about 4.5% of the population died from disease and starvation in every year of the four-year conflict. During the DRC Civil War, even if we accept the overly pessimistic estimate of 5 million indirect deaths, it would amount to 1% of the country's population per year, a reduction of more than fourfold from Korea. It's not easy to see the bright side in the developing world, where the remnants of war continue to cause tremendous misery. The effort to whittle down the numbers that quantify the misery can seem heartless, especially when the numbers serve as propaganda for raising money and attention. But there is a moral imperative in getting the facts right, and not just to maintain credibility. The discovery that fewer people are dying in wars all over the world can thwart cynicism among compassion-fatigued newsreaders who might otherwise think that poor countries are irredeemable hellholes. And a better understanding of what drove the numbers down can steer us toward doing things that make people better off rather than congratulating ourselves on how altruistic we are. Among the surprises in the statistics are that some things that sound exciting, like instant independence, natural resources, revolutionary Marxism, when it is effective, and electoral democracy, when it is not, can increase deaths from violence. And some things that sound boring, like effective law enforcement, openness to the world economy, UN peacekeepers, and Plumpy Nut, can decrease them. The trajectory of genocide. Of all the varieties of violence of which our sorry species is capable, genocide stands apart, not only as the most heinous, but as the hardest to comprehend. We can readily understand why, from time to time, people enter into deadly quarrels over money, honor, or love, why they punish wrongdoers to excess, and why they take up arms to combat other people who have taken up arms. But that someone should want to slaughter millions of innocents, including women, children, and the elderly, seems to insult any claim we may have to comprehend our kind. Whether it is called genocide, killing people because of their race, religion, ethnicity, or other indelible group membership, politicide, killing people because of their political affiliation, or democide, any mass killings of civilians by a government or militia, killing by category targets people for what they are rather than what they do, and thus seems to flout the usual motives of gain, fear, and vengeance. Genocide also shocks the imagination by the sheer number of its victims. Rummel, who was among the first historians to try to count them all, famously estimated that during the 20th century, 169 million people were killed by their governments. The number is, to be sure, a highball estimate, but most atrocitologists agree that in the 20th century, more people were killed by democides than by wars. Matthew White, in a comprehensive overview of the published estimates, reckons that 81 million people were killed by democide and another 40 million by man-made famines, mostly by Stalin and Mao, for a total of 121 million. Wars, in comparison, killed 37 million soldiers and 27 million civilians in battle, and another 18 million in the resulting famines, for a total of 82 million deaths. White adds, though, that about half of the democide deaths took place during wars and may not have been possible without them. Killing so many people in so short a time requires methods of mass production of death that add another layer of horror. The Nazis' gas chambers and crematoria will stand forever as the most shocking visual symbols of genocide. But modern chemistry and railroads are by no means necessary for high-throughput killing. When the French revolutionaries suppressed a revolt in the Vendée region in 1793, they hit upon the idea of packing prisoners into barges, sinking them below the water's surface long enough to drown the human cargo, and then floating them up for the next batch. Even during the Holocaust, the gas chambers were not the most efficient means of killing. The Nazis killed more people with their Einsatzgruppen, or mobile firing squads, which were foreshadowed by other teams of quick-moving soldiers with projectile weapons such as Assyrians in chariots and Mongols on horses. During the genocide of Hutus by Tutsis in Burundi in 1972, a predecessor of the reverse genocide in Rwanda 22 years later, a perpetrator explained, "Several techniques, several. One can gather 2,000 persons in a house, in a prison, let us say. There are some halls which are large. The house is locked. The men are left there for 15 days without eating, without drinking. Then one opens. One finds cadavers. Not beaten, not anything. Dead." The bland military term siege hides the fact that depriving a city of food and finishing off the weakened survivors is a time-honored and cost-effective form of extermination. As Frank Chalk and Kurt Johansson point out in The History and Sociology of Genocide, the authors of history textbooks hardly ever reported what the razing of an ancient city meant for its inhabitants. One exception is the Book of Deuteronomy, which offers a backdated prophecy that was based on the Assyrian or Babylonian conquest. In the desperate straits to which the enemy siege reduces you, you will eat the fruit of your womb, the flesh of your sons and daughters whom the Lord your God has given you. Even the most refined and gentle of men among you will begrudge food to his own brother, to the wife whom he embraces, and to the last of his remaining children, giving to none of them any of the flesh of his children whom he is eating, because nothing else remains to him, in the desperate straits to which the enemy siege will reduce you in all of your towns. She who is the most refined and gentle among you, so gentle and refined that she does not venture to set the sole of her foot on the ground, will begrudge food to the husband whom she embraces, to her own son and to her own daughter, begrudging even the afterbirth that comes out from between her thighs and the children that she bears, because she will eat them in secret for lack of anything else, in the desperate straits to which the enemy siege will reduce you in your towns. Apart from numbers and methods, genocides sear the moral imagination by the gratuitous sadism indulged in by the perpetrators. Eyewitness accounts from every continent and decade recount how victims are taunted, tormented, and mutilated before being put to death. In The Brothers Karamazov, Dostoevsky commented on Turkish atrocities in Bulgaria during the Russo-Turkish War of 1877 through 78. When unborn children were ripped from their mothers' wombs and prisoners were nailed by their ears to a fence overnight before being hanged. People speak sometimes about the animal cruelty of man, but that is terribly unjust and offensive to animals. No animal could ever be so cruel as a man, so artfully, so artistically cruel. A tiger simply gnaws and tears, that is all he can do. It would never occur to him to nail people by their ears overnight, even if he were able to do it. My own reading of histories of genocide has left me with images to disturb sleep for a lifetime. I'll recount two that lodge in the mind, not because of any gore, though such accounts are common enough, but because of their cold-bloodedness. Both are taken from the philosopher Jonathan Glover's Humanity, a Moral History of the 20th Century. During the Chinese Cultural Revolution of 1966 through 75, Mao encouraged marauding Red Guards to terrorize class enemies, including teachers, managers, and the descendants of landlords and rich peasants, killing perhaps 7 million. In one incident, young men ransacking an old couple's house found boxes of precious French glass. When the old man begged them not to destroy the glass, one of the group hit him in the mouth with a club, leaving him spitting out blood and teeth. The students smashed the glass and left the couple on their knees, crying. During the Holocaust, Christian Wirth commanded a slave labor compound in Poland, where Jews were worked to death, sorting the clothes of their murdered compatriots. Their children had been taken from them and sent to the death camps. Wirth allowed one exception. One Jewish boy, around 10, was given sweets and dressed up as a little SS man. Wirth and he rode among the prisoners, Wirth on a white horse and the boy on a pony, both using machine guns to kill prisoners, including the boy's mother, at close range. Glover allows himself a comment. To this ultimate expression of contempt and mockery, no reaction of disgust and anger is remotely adequate. How could people do these things? Making sense of killing by category, insofar as we can do so at all, must begin with the psychology of categories. People sort other people into mental pigeonholes according to their affiliations, customs, appearances, and beliefs. Though it's tempting to think of this stereotyping as a kind of mental defect, categorization is indispensable to intelligence. Categories allow us to make inferences from a few observed qualities to a larger number of unobserved ones. If I note the color and shape of a fruit and classify it as a raspberry, I can infer that it will taste sweet, satisfy my hunger, and not poison me. Politically correct sensibilities may bridle at the suggestion that a group of people, like a variety of fruit, may have features in common. But if they didn't, there would be no cultural diversity to celebrate and no ethnic qualities to be proud of. Groups of people cohere because they really do share traits, albeit statistically. So a mind that generalizes about people from their category membership is not ipso facto defective. African Americans today really are more likely to be on welfare than whites. Jews really do have higher average incomes than WASPs, and business students really are more politically conservative than students in the arts. On average. The problem with categorization is that it often goes beyond the statistics. For one thing, when people are pressured, distracted, or in an emotional state, they forget that a category is an approximation and act as if a stereotype applies to every last man, woman, and child. For another, people tend to moralize their categories, assigning praiseworthy traits to their allies and condemnable ones to their enemies. During World War II, for example, Americans thought that Russians had more positive traits than Germans. During the Cold War, they thought it was the other way around. Finally, people tend to essentialize groups. As children, they tell experimenters that a baby whose parents have been switched at birth will speak the language of her biological rather than her adoptive parents. As they get older, people tend to think that members of particular ethnic and religious groups share a quasi-biological essence, which makes them homogeneous, unchangeable, predictable, and distinct from other groups. The cognitive habit of treating people as instances of a category gets truly dangerous when people come into conflict. It turns Hobbes's trio of violent motives, gain, fear, and deterrence, from the bones of contention in an individual quarrel to the casus belli in an ethnic war. Historical surveys have shown that genocides are caused by this triad of motives with, as we shall see, two additional toxins spiked into the brew. Some genocides begin as matters of convenience. Natives are occupying a desirable territory or are monopolizing a source of water, food, or minerals, and invaders would rather have it for themselves. Eliminating the people is like clearing brush or exterminating pests, and is enabled by nothing fancier in our psychology than the fact that human sympathy can be turned on or off, depending on how another person is categorized. Many genocides of indigenous peoples are little more than expedient grabs of land or slaves, with the victims typed as less than human. Such genocides include the numerous expulsions and massacres of Native Americans by settlers or governments in the Americas, the brutalization of African tribes by King Leopold of Belgium in the Congo Free State, the extermination of the Herero by German colonists in Southwest Africa, and the attack on Darfuris by government-encouraged Janjaweed militias in the 2000s. When conquerors find it expedient to suffer the natives to live so that they can provide tribute and taxes, genocide can have a second down-to-earth function. A reputation for a willingness to commit genocide comes in handy for a conqueror because it allows him to present a city with an ultimatum to surrender or else. To make the threat credible, the invader has to be prepared to carry it out. This was the rationale behind the annihilation of the cities of Western Asia by Genghis Khan and his Mongol hordes. Once the conquerors have absorbed a city or territory into an empire, they may keep it in line with the threat that they will come down on any revolt like a ton of bricks. In 68 CE, the governor of Alexandria called in Roman troops to put down a rebellion by the Jews against Roman rule. According to the historian Flavius Josephus, once the Jews were forced back, they were unmercifully and completely destroyed. Some were caught in the open field, others forced into their houses, which were plundered and then set on fire. The Romans showed no mercy to the infants, had no regard for the aged, and went on in the slaughter of persons of every age until all the place was overflowed with blood, and 50,000 Jews lay dead. Similar tactics have been used in 20th century counterinsurgency campaigns, such as the ones by the Soviets in Afghanistan and right-wing military governments in Indonesia and Central America. When a dehumanized people is in a position to defend itself or turn the tables, it can set a Hobbesian trap of group-against-group fear. Either side may see the other as an existential threat that must be preemptively taken out. After the breakup of Yugoslavia in the 1990s, Serbian nationalists' genocide of Bosnians and Kosovars was partly fueled by fears that they would be the victims of massacres themselves. If members of a group have seen their comrades victimized, have narrowly escaped victimization themselves, or paranoiaically worry they have been targeted for victimization, they may stoke themselves into a moralistic fury and seek vengeance on their perceived assailants. Like all forms of revenge, a retaliatory massacre is pointless once it has to be carried out, but a well-advertised and implacable drive to carry it out, regardless of its costs at the time, may have been programmed into people's brains by evolution, cultural norms, or both, as a way to make the deterrent credible. These Hobbesian motives don't fully explain why predation, preemption, or revenge should be directed against entire groups of people, rather than the individuals who get in the way or make trouble. The cognitive habit of pigeonholing may be one reason, and another is explained in The Godfather, Part 2, when the young Vito Corleone's mother begs the Sicilian Don to spare the boy's life. "Widow, Don Francesco, you murdered my husband because he would not bend, and his oldest son, Paolo, because he swore revenge. But Vitone is only 9 and dumb-witted. He never speaks." Francesco: "I'm not afraid of his words." Widow: "He is weak." Francesco: "He will grow strong." Widow: "The child cannot harm you." Francesco: "He will be a man, and then he will come for revenge." And come for revenge he does. Later in the film, the grown Vito returns to Sicily, seeks an audience with the Don, whispers his name into the old man's ear, and cuts him open like a sturgeon. The solidarity among the members of a family, clan, or tribe, in particular their resolve to avenge killings, makes them all fair game for someone with a bone to pick with any one of them, though equal-sized groups in frequent contact tend to constrain their revenge to an eye-for-an-eye reciprocity. Repeated violations may turn episodic anger into chronic hatred. As Aristotle wrote, "The angry man wishes the object of his anger to suffer in return. Hatred wishes its object not to exist." When one side finds himself with an advantage in numbers or tactics, it may seize the opportunity to impose a final solution. Feuding tribes are well aware of genocide's practical advantages. The anthropologist Rafael Karsten worked with the Jivaro of Amazonian Ecuador, a tribe whose rate of deaths in war is close to 40%. He recounts their ways of war. "Whereas the small feuds within the sub-tribes have the character of a private blood revenge based on the principles of just retaliation, the wars between the different tribes are in principle wars of extermination. In these there is no question of weighing life against life. The aim is to completely annihilate the enemy tribe. The victorious party is all the more anxious to leave no single person of the enemy's people, not even small children, alive, as they fear lest these should later appear as avengers against the victors." Half a world away, the anthropologist Margaret Durham offered a similar vignette from an Albanian tribe that ordinarily abided by norms for measured revenge. In February 1912, an amazing case of wholesale justice was reported to me. A certain family of the Fandi Barak sub-tribe had long been notorious for evil-doing, robbing, shooting, and being a pest to the tribe. A gathering of all the heads condemned all the males of the family to death. Men were appointed to lay in wait for them on a certain day and pick them off, and on that day the whole 17 of them were shot. One was but 5, and another but 12 years old. I protested against thus killing children who must be innocent and was told it was bad blood and must not be further propagated. Such was the belief in heredity that it was proposed to kill an unfortunate woman who was pregnant lest she should bear a male, and so renew the evil. The essentialist notion of bad blood is one of several biological metaphors inspired by a fear of the revenge of the cradle. People anticipate that if they leave even a few of a defeated enemy alive, the remnants will multiply and cause trouble down the line. Human cognition often works by analogy, and the concept of an irksome collection of procreating beings repeatedly calls to mind the concept of vermin. Perpetrators of genocide the world over keep rediscovering the same metaphors to the point of cliché. Despised people are rats, snakes, maggots, lice, flies, parasites, cockroaches, or, in parts of the world where they are pests, monkeys, baboons, and dogs. "Kill the nits and you will have no lice," wrote an English commander in Ireland in 1641, justifying an order to kill thousands of Irish Catholics. "A nit would make a louse," recalled a Californian settler leader in 1856, before slaying 240 Yuki in revenge for their killing of a horse. "Nits make lice," said Colonel John Chivington before the Sand Creek Massacre, which killed hundreds of Cheyenne and Arapaho in 1864. Cankers, cancers, bacilli, and viruses are other insidious biological agents that lend themselves as figures of speech in the poetics of genocide. When it came to the Jews, Hitler mixed his metaphors, but they were always biological. Jews were viruses. Jews were blood-sucking parasites. Jews were a mongrel race. Jews had poisonous blood. The human mind has evolved a defense against contamination by biological agents, the emotion of disgust. Ordinarily triggered by bodily secretions, animal parts, parasitic insects and worms, and vectors of disease, disgust impels people to eject the polluting substance and anything that looks like it or has been in contact with it. Disgust is easily moralized, defining a continuum in which one pole is identified with spirituality, purity, chastity, and cleansing, and the other with animality, defilement, carnality, and contamination. And so we see disgusting agents as not just physically repellent, but also morally contemptible. Many metaphors in the English language for a treacherous person use a disease vector as their vehicle. A rat, a louse, a worm, a cockroach. The infamous 1990s term for forced displacement and genocide was ethnic cleansing. Metaphorical thinking goes in both directions. Not only do we apply disgust metaphors to morally devalued peoples, but we tend to morally devalue people who are physically disgusting, a phenomenon we encountered in Chapter 4 when considering Lynn Hunt's theory that a rise in hygiene in Europe caused a decline in cruel punishments. At one pole of the continuum, white-clad ascetics who undergo rituals of purification are revered as holy men and women. At the other, people living in degradation and filth are reviled as subhuman. The chemist and writer Primo Levi described this spiral during the transport of Jews to the death camps in Germany. The SS escort did not hide their amusement at the sight of men and women squatting wherever they could, on the platforms and in the middle of the tracks, and the German passengers openly expressed their disgust. "People like this deserve their fate. Just look how they behave. These are not Menschen, human beings, but animals. It's clear as the light of day." The emotional pathways to genocide, anger, fear, and disgust, can occur in various combinations. In Worse Than War, A History of 20th Century Genocide, the political scientist Daniel Goldhagen points out that not all genocides have the same causes. He classifies them according to whether the victim group is dehumanized, a target of moralized disgust, demonized, a target of moralized anger, both, or neither. A dehumanized group may be exterminated like vermin, such as the heroes in the eyes of German colonists, Armenians in the eyes of Turks, Black Darfuris in the eyes of Sudanese Muslims, and many indigenous peoples in the eyes of European settlers. A demonized group, in contrast, is thought to be equipped with the standard human reasoning faculties, which makes them all the more culpable for embracing a heresy or rejecting the one true faith. Among these modern heretics were the victims of communist autocracies and the victims of their opposite number, the right-wing dictatorships in Chile, Argentina, Indonesia, and El Salvador. Then there are the out-and-out demons, groups that manage to be both repulsively subhuman and despicably evil. This is how the Nazis saw the Jews, and how Hutus and Tutsis saw each other. Finally, there